Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Welcome back, myself and Dan here. Keith Andrews on the line, evening.
Hey, Joe, how's it going, Dan? You well?
Hi, Keith.
So, you kicked off on Sky Sports, didn't you?
No, I watched it back to see if I went a bit more than maybe I should have, but I'm very comfortable with what I said. I think you both know I'm a fan. I get a little bit emotional about the team, and look, before I played, I paid to go and watch. Since I've retired, I've gone with family, friends to games. If I haven't been working, I go as a fan. I feel I'm well placed to have an opinion. I totally agree with everything I said 22 hours ago, whatever it was. It still doesn't sit very well. It's still painful. I don't see it getting better anytime soon.
We've a bit more time here, thankfully, than TV, which is always so time pressured. So let's start with the performance firstly, the 90 minutes. What did you make of it?
Well, first 10, 15 minutes, I thought was positive. Looked at Saturday's style of kind of the system and the 3-5 at the back, and there was a few issues that I had with that. So in the first 10 to 15 minutes, I'm seeing a little bit of progression with Kevin Long and James McLean. Kevin Long was coming out into those grey areas, those little full-back areas, to let James McLean bounce up and engage Connor Roberts. So it wasn't just pinned back in as a back five. Martin, time and time again, speaks about being on the front foot in his press conferences the day before or during the international breaks, and we were on the front foot. That's how we got the opportunity with Cyrus Christie, because we had four or five bodies high up the field, and we were aggressive, looking to stop Wales from kind of getting the run of the park, which we allowed them last month. So, encouraging signs, could have taken the lead. I felt then Wales kind of got a grip of the game, got into their groove, and we retreated. That's pretty much the way the game went. And then in the first half, I thought, for the last 15-20 minutes, Wales were the better side, looked more likely, got into their groove. Second half, they increased the tempo. And you can tell exactly what Wales are trying to do, where it comes back to us. On the flip side of that, I don't know what we're trying to do.
So what were Wales trying to do in the second half then, that Ireland weren't trying to do, Keith?
Well, look, in possession, out of possession. Let's talk about in possession. You can tell what way they played. The fullback split high, wide, Roberts, Davis. And then Joe Allen in the second half, I thought, played a real kind of mature role and pushed Matt Smith a bit higher. So Joe Allen was the one who was looking to receive off the centre-half. And the movement of Lawrence Wilson-Brooks, it's not just something that happens. Yes, they have a little bit of licence and freedom to go into certain areas, but they're triggered. You know, one of them is running off to create space for the other. The pass for Joe Allen in the main is easier than when our midfielders are looking up. And then again, you flip that for us. We've got a back three now, kind of finding its feet. Richard Keogh steps out. It's a bit like, oh, am I going long? Am I trying to find Harry Arthur into a deeper midfield role? Or is Matt Doherty, is he going high? Is he going wide? What's the movement from the front players? And again, it just doesn't seem to be in sync.
I would suggest certainly in the first half, there was a real determination to go short to Arthur and Christie and Hendrick. And time and time again, what seemed to happen was that the ball came straight back to them. You know, Christie, for obvious reasons, found it very difficult to get turned. You know, I'd say it was a complete culture shock for him to have players suddenly behind him and all around him. And then Arthur and Hendrick didn't overly do a good job. One of the few players maybe who did was Callum Robinson. When he got a chance, he would get turned. So, like, some of the responsibility there goes to our midfielders, actually, when they did get the ball at times. I was looking at them last night, and even, you know, I'm very torn on where I am in O'Neill at the moment, but I was looking at the midfielders and saying, well, they know they should be a bit braver there. They actually refuse to turn on the ball when they get it.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't blame Cyrus Christie at all, Joe, because it's not his position. He is very, very effective with the play in front of him, grass run into. With the others, they should be, and they could have done better. They should have been able to find better passes. If anything, for me, when I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, you're just so low on confidence. Those gaps, those passes just look harder when confidence is rock bottom, and that's the way it looked for me. But there's no doubt about it, they should have been better, because they did have, especially in the first half, you hit the nail on the head, there was time, there was space, because first 15-20 minutes we were the stronger team. We were having more play, more passes, which was a bit of a shock to the system, but it quickly turned around, didn't it? And Wales got a good grip of the game.
Yeah, the other thing I guess you could say, if we're looking for positives here, then The team did press a bit higher. You mentioned McLean being further up the field. Like, the Christie chance comes from a team trying to press further up. So, you know, we are deeply suspicious of the work that's being done, or more to the point, not being done on the training ground. But it is fair to say that from the Denmark game to last night, it did look like some things had been addressed.
I agree. And those points that I mentioned about Kevin Long and McLean, it wasn't a back five. It was a back three at times with Doherty, Pushner and McLean. And at times it was a back four when the ball was on the left-hand side. McLean was higher and engaged, and Matt Doherty would drop back around and it looked like a back four. And you both were at the game last night. Some people that watch on TV don't get to see the full picture. But if you looked at the Cyrus Christie opportunity, the back three was right up. The distances between the units was very, very good. Whereas in the main, what we see from this team is two, three people going pressed and there's a big gap to the midfield, or there's a big gap to the back three, stroke four, whatever we're playing. Whereas I totally agree, last night, especially in the first 15 to 20 minutes, it looked like there'd been some work done and it looked a lot more compact and organised.
So then, because you sort of feel like a manager should go on the back of a crisis performance or a crisis week, does that not, everything we just discussed there, does that not grant O'Neill a stay of execution here, no?
Well, it's a build-up, Joe. I said last night it's been a disastrous 12 months, and it has been.
Yeah.
You know, results, the manner of them, the manner of the performances, not knowing what we're getting from game to game. Obviously, the off-field problems that we've had with Roy Keane and the Walters and Harry Arthur not turning up. Declan Rice, how much they can control that situation, I'm not entirely sure. But it has been a circus, and obviously the results haven't been good enough. And like, I'm going to games. You don't know what you're going to get game to game. And I think it's the same for the players. I really do. They don't know what system, what shape, what the expectation levels are. We're 5 years into his reign next month. And you compare that to Ryan Giggs, who's been in the job since January. And you can tell exactly what they're trying to do. Mm. And look, last night, the argument Martin always makes is about the level of player. And look, some of these Welsh players, I firmly believe, will go on to bigger and better things. But at the moment, three of them are playing in the Premier League of the starting 11. Mm. Let's not forget who they were missing from last month. Four of the starting 11, obviously Bale, Ramsey, Ampadu and Meppham, who I do really like, and Meppham as well. Last night they had three. We had six Premier League players. We had a vastly more experienced side, and we still get outdone.
Keith, Martin O'Neill said after the game last night that he still genuinely feels Ireland will qualify for 2020. Are you feeling that optimism now?
Well, because of the new format, Dan, I wouldn't say I'm being optimistic at the moment, but because of the new format, you're going to get a couple of bites of the cherry minimum, aren't you, because of the way this new qualification process goes. But the seedings do matter. Now we are going to be definitely seeded with a group with one of the teams from A and more than likely one from B. So it's going to prove a lot more difficult, but we still have the opportunity to go into those actual qualifiers, that's the way you want to phrase it. Come March, we're going to have another opportunity. Will things look a little bit better there? Coleman, Brady, McCarthy, etc. back. Will Shawnee Maguire be, at that stage, one of the best strikers in the Championship, which I think he has the capabilities to do? Then maybe it looks a little bit more positive, but standing here right now, it's very hard to get excited about anything.
Yeah. You see, we're back to the same old argument, which was there in Trapattoni's day, and it's extended into the O'Neill era. And I know you made the argument last night he needs to stop going on about Robbie Keane, but the fact remains that the quality of players is just, it's thin, and we have to be realistic, you know? And, I mean, maybe you can explain the Harry Arthur tackle, because it was one of the most bizarre things I've seen in a football field, actually. It was like he saw the ball and then lifted his foot away, and you wonder, what can Martin O'Neill do past a certain point, you know? I take your point about shape and everything else. What I'm asking in a roundabout way here, ultimately, is given the cost involved, we're talking about a couple of million here, and then the cost to go out and get another management team, are we at the point where it's so clear that the manager is the issue, that it is the right thing for Irish football to do, to say, Martin, we're going to cut ties here ahead of the qualification for 2020 in March? Are we at that point, really?
Yeah, Joe, on the player side of things, look, it kind of suggests I'm excusing players from everything. They need to stand up. They need to be a little bit braver in the way they're playing. You know, even during my time where we did have some tricky times under Trapattoni. We had a defined way of playing, and we got a lot of criticism for that style, but we knew how we were playing. But even within that, there were moments, there were games where players stood up to be counted, you know, because they knew it wasn't good enough. I'm not seeing that at the moment. And you've highlighted, like, Harry Arthur's tackle, the naivety of it. That's Harry Arthur. That's Harry Arthur playing in a holding central midfield role. You just don't put him there. It's as simple as that for me, because that is what he is like. You're not going to change a player that much during an international break. It's what goes on at club level in the main. And in terms of the quality in the final tournament, yes, we haven't got that sparkle. We haven't got that zip, that pace, that trickery. We haven't got that invention, creativity. That's what we don't have. But we can still... I'm very realistic what he can do with this team, but I still think he can do a lot better with the hand that he has at the moment. And in answer to your question about will they let go of him because of the financial element to this, I don't think they will. I think we all know about the debt of the stadium that's still getting managed while still trying to kind of shuffle money around different departments, grassroots, etc. I don't see it changing, but I don't see the performances changing much on the flip side of that either.
So you're fairly dismayed at the whole situation then. Your sense is financially we're stuck with the management team and you don't think the management team is right.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, Joe. That's pretty a fair reflection of where I'm standing at the moment, and I'm not very positive about it. It's paining me, but I would suggest that's pretty much where it is. But on the flip side of that, you know, you alluded to it, Dan, about qualification for 2020. It's still going to be there because of the new format, but getting through these games now, this month into November, it's just looking bleak, and then hopefully by March we've something a little bit more to cheer about.
Just looking at the full-time whistle last night, Keith, you know, the players sort of sank to the ground, looking, you know, it's pretty sort of picture of desolation. How do you think the players are feeling now? Because there is this line is going out, you know, that is going out there, and it's been repeated, and even sometimes the manager has alluded to it, that we don't have the players, or that the players that we have, you know, that Ireland have at the moment, well, you know, we know the things that we lack. Do you think there's a possibility that grades with players that they keep hearing that message?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, Dan. And I would liken it to Mourinho, the way he keeps on going on about a centre-half and what am I supposed to do and I need a centre-half. Ed Woodward, go and buy me this fella, go and buy me that fella. That's what I would liken it to. And then we see Eric Boye or Jones or Smalling, whoever, make mistakes or not look like anything near they can do. Is there any real surprise? Is there any real surprise we see that from some of the Irish players and certainly the centre forwards? Because Shane Long has been hearing this for a number of years about Robbie Keane, and if only we had him. We don't have him. We need to move on. Because, and I mentioned it last night, before Robbie Keane, our top goal scorers were Niall Quinn, Stapleton, Soldiers. They were all in around 20 goals. So that's probably more the reality of where we are, where we're going to be for a long time in the future, unless something special comes along. The one thing I would say is, and you about now, some of the underage teams are doing really well, but it's a few years away yet in terms of, probably a couple of years anyway, in terms of challenging for first team spots. But yeah, it's...
Why do you think it's stopped working? You know, because we're talking here and managers who've done things the right way have not got big results at times for Ireland. We don't often beat teams in the top 10 in the world, and O'Neill's pulled out some big nights. We mentioned the Germany game, obviously. The Bosnia game was, you know, was a big night, what they did in Italy and Lille, admittedly a weakened Italy side, but they still have to go and do it on a big stage. And we were just remarking here, you have to go back, we're basically at 2 years now to Vienna 2016 and that big win. And since then, in competitive games, I don't really count friendlies, in competitive games were two wins in 11 in competitive games, Moldova and the Welsh game in Cardiff, which is another big night to be fair. But why has a rot set in? Why do you think that's happened? Especially over the last 2 years, when the first couple of years were decent.
Yeah, it's very difficult to put your finger on exactly why. I do think there has been a little bit of a change of certain senior players dropping out that have made a difference. People will point to Wes Hoolan. Look, I've always been quite positive the first few years, and certain instances and the Wes Hoolan debate about always playing, I didn't always buy into that. When we finished second in the group ahead of Austria, Wales, I thought that was a good achievement because with no real divine right to be finishing ahead of those. I've only really started to get a little bit negative since the second leg of the Denmark game. Even the first leg, I was comfortable with that. I didn't mind that at all in terms of how we set up. why has it gone this wrong? You guess into a degree. I go back to the squad that he has available and what they get at club level. I don't think is getting matched at international level
in terms of coaching.
The coaching, the detail, and it's what they need. You look at the vast majority of those players now, they've come through the academy system. I've said this before, time and time again. They need detail, even down to our set pieces, which on Saturday against Denmark were nothing short of shocking.
And you said last night you think morale is bad. And do you think that's not just because of the results? Do you think morale is bad because they realise they're not getting the coaching?
Well, I think that's maybe one factor. Morale is bad. You've only got to listen to what's crept out over the last couple of months in terms of the little arguments and that seem to be around. That always comes to the fore when results, performances aren't very good. And Dan mentioned about last night at the final whistle. I thought that was very, very evident that it was literally, I think the commentator mentioned, it looked like they'd lost a cup final. They looked that low that I haven't seen that type of reaction probably since Denmark last year. Like even Wales last month, there was more embarrassment. Johnny Walters used that word the other day, whereas Denmark back in November, that was literally soul destroying. That's the way they looked last night. So that's when the management team need to get it going again. But I think they themselves look very, very low.
What's your professional interpretation of the last 20 minutes? Because I got like torn, so I'd be very curious to get a sense of what people in the game might think. On the one hand, he threw on the three forwards and really, really went for it, you know, and created chances. And it would have been tempting for Martin and Roy to say to each other, do you know what, we're under pressure. Let's just take a 1-0 defeat here and get out of here. Let's not risk losing 2 or 3-0, which they easily could have. Like Wales, Wales countered and they had like a 3-on-2 almost every single time. So it was a really risky and you could argue ballsy decision for O'Neill to go for it at the end. Should he be commended for that, or did you interpret that as desperation and actually no good?
No, I would have been okay with us conceding a second goal if it had been caught in the counter-attack. I felt he had to take off one of the centre-halves. I said it during commentary because they ended up marking Tyler Roberts' three centre-halves up against ones, which was ridiculous. And Long or Keogh stepping into those areas, they're not going to give you that much really in an attacking sense. So I didn't mind that at all. The issue I had with it was, okay, we're going to stick three centre-forwards on, but who's getting the service to them? Nothing really was changed in the midfield three. They were still playing quite narrow and just going about their business as they'd done previously during the game. James McLean was actually playing as a left back and a left winger. Shane Long actually ended up playing like the right winger, which we all know isn't his game. So I made the point afterwards, has this been worked on? Because at club level, and I know at club level you get a lot more time, you do work on these factors. You do work on, if you go down to 10 men, this is how we defend. If the opposition goes down to 10 men, this is what we have to do to tweak it. So we're trying to get back in the game. It's not just a case of getting your goal scorers on the pitch. How are you going to get that service towards them? You may as well have stuck Shane Duffy up front, gone ultra direct, and he would have caused more problems, and gone the Thomas Delaney room, calling us a little bit primitive. I wouldn't have had a problem with that. And in fact, going forward, I don't really have a problem with that. I just want us to have a plan. I don't expect us to be popping it around like Man City at the moment with the personnel we have. But I do expect more than what we're getting.
Yeah. Did you interpret the boos at the end as for the Harry Arter shot, which, you know, because when you were in the stadium, I certainly thought it was the boos for the handball, because Arter, I don't know if it showed up on TV, Arter made a big point of appealing for the handball to the referee and ran over to the referee, and then he blew the final whistle, and I took the booing then as a reaction to that moment as opposed to O'Neill.
Yeah, I did. I thought it was due to the handball, the decision, the kind of protestations of Harry Arter towards the referee. I think that was more along those lines, but I think in general, fans, we heard it during the game against Denmark, moans and groans in the second half, just everybody a bit subdued, fed up, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that's the general feeling. I think there's just mass scepticism surrounding the whole kind of team and management team at the moment.
Me and Dan were sort of talking here, and I was wondering, you know, if we're going to replace, say there was a replacement happening in the morning, like would it be like a Tony Pulis, Sam Allardyce, who could come in and work with the group as we have it? Or can we genuinely aspire to play more technical football with the players that we have and to implement it pretty quickly?
Well, I think you need a plan first and foremost. And for me, I've just alluded to it there, I have no problem with it being a little bit direct, a little bit pragmatic in the approach, been difficult to break down. Nobody comes and plays against us in an easy way and enjoys playing against us. I want teams to hate playing against us. So if it was along those lines, I think you'd get results first and foremost, and from that, that breeds confidence. And then confidence in sports, as we are well aware, just makes players play with more freedom. And then the point you're making about Hendrick and Arthur, if we're on a run now where they hadn't lost a game in 9 and 10 games, they would be getting on the ball. They would be driving into midfield and popping passes off. Whereas at the moment, there's a real tentative feel around with the way the team are playing. It's nervy, it's edgy. They don't really know exactly what way they're going. So short term, I certainly think that could be an approach. Whether this management team are capable of doing that, I'm not too sure. Although there was a few signs over the last 2 games to suggest that it certainly has improved a little bit. But let's not forget who we were playing against, lads.
Yeah.
It's Christian Eriksen, Les Denmark, and Bale Ramsey, etc.
At home.
Yeah. So come on.
Well, on that note,
I'm sorry I haven't cheered you up.
I didn't expect you to be fair.
No, sorry, lads.
That's fair enough.
We've got the Keith Andrews show tomorrow, so I think I'm on with you, actually. So we'll tease things out a bit more, and we get the tactics board out again, and you can show us what you like.
A few bits and bobs.
Yeah, I think that'll be worth doing. So that's 12:30 on Facebook Live tomorrow. If you want to get Keith's show live, you can podcast it as well, or you can watch it back on YouTube. So we'll do that tomorrow, 12:30. Keith, thanks a million.
Thanks, lads. Take care.
Cheers, Keith.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Oh. All right, Dan, let's cut the crap here. Let's cut the crap. Let's get right to it.
I sat in
on the press conference last night. I was finished and I toddled down from the 5th floor down to ground floor.
You just got the lift, Joe. Everyone else got the lift. So did you actually toddle down?
No, I got the lift.
All right, okay.
The waiting for that, but by the way,
lift. The wait for that lift is something else.
Sorry, yeah. That's the worst lift in the world.
Normally it's tough. Like, it's meant to be a press, I mean, again, I could just imagine no one caring about this.
Yeah, no, sorry, let's move on.
It's meant to be a press lift, but it stops at 4:32, people getting on with trolleys, all sorts. It's not great when you're under a bit of deadline
pressure. No, like, legitimately, you can be waiting for a long, long time. Anyway, I toddled on down in the lift. And went to Martin O'Neill's press conference. We'll play you a few clips. Suffice to say, it wasn't great. So, as generally is the case with these things, it's one question per journalist at a time in a row. Don't ask me why. I mean, it's just deliberately difficult for everyone. So, one question and then move on. And there's long silences sometimes between questions. I think people are almost saying, well, should I ask one? Or my sense is, I mean, there's a few elephants in the room that people don't want to bring up, like, Martin, you're in big trouble here, you know, and
It's a difficult format.
It's like passing the baton on. Yeah, it's a terrible format. And so we'll play some clips. Ryan Giggs came in, and obviously he was in great form. And
it's a great format when you're winning. It's like, here, I can speak to the world. Here's how I did it.
Yeah. Actually, interestingly, Giggs made the point that we had a really small team out there, and it was something we were really worried about. But the way the players stood up was just fantastic. They won every header. They came into the box. They really fought hard.
Ashley Williams got the big G up, didn't he?
Said, man of the match by a million miles, he said. Mm. By a million miles, Williams. He thought he was brilliant.
He has been having a bit of a nightmare every year, so it's probably, there was a bit of motivational talk containment in.
Talked about the young players. Kept being asked about the young players, because you can imagine that must be a real team that the journalists are.
Can you imagine the buzz of watching, you know, if you're covering Wales or from Wales, your team with like 3 21-year-olds.
An 18-year-old and a 19-year-old
in your like 5-year front six. Mm. Can you imagine that? You know, I can remember a time when...
I can't even imagine that in our under-21s.
All those players playing in Olomouc back in the day, all the friendlies or all the debuts that were given out, you know, Keane and Duff all coming through, etc. What a story that must be.
Yeah, and you know, he was playing it down a little bit. He was like, yeah, no, it's great, but you have to have the experience in there. You have to have the Ashley Williams in there, the Wayne Hennessys. They're the ones that really spine of the team. And Joe Allen was so good as well. So, you know, everybody was happy. Everything was good about Wales. Giggsy toddled off into the night and he was happy. Mm. Martin O'Neill comes in, like, tense, I would have said. Tense.
It's not a great... I mean, he is intense around games, but after a defeat, it hangs. The silences, I don't know if they go on for as long as it seems, but they seem like pretty long silences.
Here's a sense of one of the more difficult moments. So a journalist basically sort of said, this was a few questions in, and as I'm thinking here, it is, when you step back from it for a second, this is grim. Like the whole football world and the media and our own involvement, and it's like a man being asked about his job security. There is something very undignified
Absolutely.
About all of us involved.
And it's not even about, at that point as well, it's not necessarily always about asking the most pertinent question at that stage. If you have, say, newspaper asking questions and that, it's a case of need a back page answer quickly here, need the main issue addressed.
Yeah.
So you may just have to cut to the chase in a way that you wouldn't if it was a sit-down interview building up
Correct.
To something.
Yeah, because everyone knows this could be wrapped up at any second. So eventually, a few questions in, you know, give us your initial thoughts and what did you think and did you feel there was an improvement and all that kind of stuff. And then somebody said, look, there might be a sense that you need to win back the support of some of the crowd, or maybe even win back the support of some people in the FAI, Martin. You know, what would you have to say about that? And this will just give you a sense of the kind of atmosphere.
Well, I think that you've questioned me now for 4.5 years. That wouldn't be unusual.
End of answer. Long pause. Next question?
Yeah.
Nobody was jumping for the microphone at that point. So it's that stilted environment. And then he disappears into the room on the side. And what happens then...
Do you look enviously, John?
What happens then is one of the greatly upsetting things for all the broadcast media is the Dan McDonalds of the world scurry after him. Up off the seat, scurrying after him.
There you go.
Notebooks out. They know they're going to get the good stuff. And so you get to talk to him in a far more
human environment. Well, that's the newspaper huddle, and it's important.
The newspaper huddle.
Well, that's what it is. it's important to newspapers. And
no, I appreciate
it. It's generally for the day after, so it'll be tomorrow morning's paper. And yeah, what you have in that setting is that you have... no microphone being passed around.
Yeah.
There's no one
conversation.
Pointing your question. It's a bit more rapid fire, and if there's a short answer, then one has to come back.
Now, so when I kick off the Hoobah show by saying let's cut the crap down, you were saying, and I've deliberately not asked you not to tell me, because if I knew I wouldn't be able to help myself alluding to it or blurting out, you just happened to say in the last half hour or so, O'Neill was really good with the paper section. It's going to be interesting tomorrow in the papers.
Yeah, it's one of the better ones, just in terms of getting an insight into his picture. As I said, I'm here. I work for Irish Independent, Joe. I'm like, get your Irish Independent tomorrow. We're actually going to publish some of the transcript, I think, just a bit of the back and forth, just to get a sense of where he's at. Now,
hostile.
Probably more bullish than hostile.
Okay, but so he was not a defeated man then.
Oh no, it's an insight into, I suppose, his perception of his position and where it stands. Okay. And probably illuminating in that sense, in terms of, you know, where we're at going forward. So I think people will take some of the quotes that will be in the, you know, in our paper and the other papers tomorrow, and they're the lines that will be brought up again over the next 18 months.
Oh, such as?
Oh, Joe. You know this gig by now.
No,
but,
I
you know this gig by now. But at the same time,
and did you do long with him?
It was around 10 minutes. Now,
okay.
No one cares. I had to nip off halfway through because I was under pressure to file for the next day's paper. That's just the nature of it as well. But there was enough people there, so it was fine. And I was more so at the back,
right,
of this one, because there was a lot of people back there.
Yeah.
Because there was probably English, you know, quite a few English papers over and stuff like that. So
yeah,
it is sometimes a better setting.
No,
I'm not saying it's Frost Nixon back there, but it's just easier.
Back in the broadcast section before all that, O'Neill was asked if a result like last night forces him to analyse his own decision making and how he sets up the team.
I'm not so sure that I've ever not asked questions about myself. You know, I really am not sure about that. I think I do. I think I've done that as a player, and I certainly have done that as a manager. And if you're asking about responsibility for it, I take responsibility for every kick that is made in that field by us. That is my job, and so that will not change. And in terms of questioning, there's no question. I do question everything that that happens in the field. I look back again to see what we may have been able to have done a little bit better, and hopefully that improvement continues. But in terms of questioning myself as a professional, both as a player and as a manager, I've always done it. I've genuinely always done it.
So as is so often the case, he says all the right things in the press conference. You can't fault that. It's perfectly rational and good and seemingly positive. And clearly when he asks himself the questions about how he prepares the team, he's happy with the answers. He was asked at one point as well, do you feel this was a big or certainly an improvement in the team's performance from the Denmark game?
Well, absolutely. I do. I absolutely do think that. I think that there is, as you say, that improvement in the game. Improvement even from Saturday. We miss a natural goal scorer on the side. Although I must admit that I thought that a young Maguire coming on, he'd give us plenty of impetus, and that's very, very encouraging considering he's only played 25 minutes of club football now in the last 3.5 months. So yeah, I think these things will help the players immensely.
So that's where he is, and that was his point of view. And it's interesting you saying the more informal setting, he certainly had maybe a bullish air and certainly not the air of a defeated man. So that's where O'Neill is. Keith Andrews was on earlier on. If you're listening on the podcast, you would have just heard him. Keith's kind of point is, like, it's not really just about last night. This is a general thing. This is a general rot, might be a strong word, but it's a general rot since maybe Vienna 2016.
Yeah.
And last night really doesn't change his sense of what's been done with the team.
That's the problem. I mean, that's the issue. If last night's game was the first game of his tenure,
yeah.
If it was the first match,
yeah.
You'd be walking away with a very different, okay, you know, we've got something to work with here.
If anything, you say, gosh, what a big improvement from his first game with Wales to
from the Denmark game. It just started then. Whereas, you know, as Keith mentioned, we're coming on towards 5 years in the job, and I sort of mentioned a bit earlier on, 11 months since Denmark, more to the point, when, you know, the 5-1, when we knew there was going to be changes and people were going to leave, and slight sympathy in terms of, okay, the friendlies that started the year, the big thing was Declan Rice and building a team around Declan Rice. And that is, so if you're talking about the time that was wasted there, that is a factor in it too, unfortunately.
That's my slight reservation. Look, I've been very critical of O'Neill, there's no doubt. But since the Denmark game, like, there aren't that many games really of note to work with as such.
I mean, there was a training camp though, and there was a 10-day training camp in the summer, which will be forever remembered for the WhatsApp audio messages describing it, rather than the patterns of play that were created during that period.
Doesn't seem like it was overly productive.
No, I give you that. That's a problem, you see.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So that's the less sympathetic, that's the very glass, you know, that's the glass a quarter empty view.
Because you're a very fair judge. You're not a clickbaiter, you're not looking for to keep people, you know, you're not that type. So I'm kind of surprised here that you're at the point where you think it actually is done.
Yeah, I it's a tough one because in the last campaign Ireland were fourth seeds and, you know, came second, and I still think off the back of that you deserve another campaign. But yet there's always this niggling sense that the campaign is a campaign too far. And there was a conscious attempt in the summer to build a positivity around the autumn.
Yeah,
you know, that was
the
plan. And you're thinking, okay, let's roll with that and see what happens.
As in O'Neill doing all the one-on-one interviews?
Yeah, it's not even just that. It was even, I mean, yeah, but part of that, I think, was about getting a message out about there's belief in the players and, you know, let's talk about the positive. Let's talk about the good things that we've got. I believe in this and that.
Mm.
So that was fine. But now, since then, we've had a really bad couple of months. And the language, again, about the players has probably gone back to be more negative than positive on what we don't have rather than what we do have.
Yeah.
And so now it does just feel grim. Yeah, it does. And a lot of people were very strong after 5-1 about there can't be another campaign. And I was just sort of a small bit, you know.
You weren't so sure then.
Wasn't so sure.
Yeah. Because in a way it was a 2-1 or 3-1 loss to Denmark, and then they had to go for it. And 5-1 is, you know.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. And the FAI had made the decision probably to stick with him at that time. And I guess my view with O'Neill has always been, do you want him to be the manager that he is, or do you want him to be the manager that you want him to be? And, you know, the FAI gave the contract to O'Neill, the manager that he is, and we knew what we were going to get.
Yeah.
And as with all these things, I do feel sometimes that, I've mentioned this before, that the language around the Irish senior team, or about Irish football generally, is always the manager. What do we need to do? Let's change the manager. Yeah. And then we play in November against Denmark, and maybe the next discussion, proper discussion we have, is maybe 4 months later. So last 24 hours, everyone's like, the structures, reform, you know, that needs to be a 12-month debate, you know, with real purpose and focus to it. So it's not just about fixing the manager and that's it.
Yeah.
But you are at the stage where you are now wondering, would it just help?
Okay. We'll see what happens in Denmark next month. We'll park Ireland for now, because we do want to go over to Julien Lorraine, our good friend, who's going to tell us about Thierry Henry, who has joined up with Monaco. That's next.
I've got everything in front of me, so I think I have it. It took me a while to get there.
Okay.
A few of the lads in there earlier on, but I think I've got it yet. The league split up into four different leagues. League A, B, C and D. If you win a group, you automatically get into a playoff for Euro 2020 by winning a group.
What?
Yeah. So if you win your group, so if we had, say, Wales and Northern Ireland, we then, I think it comes down to, so if we win League B,
yeah.
And now, not necessarily, but if say you win all the games, potentially, that gives you the chance, you've topped that group. That's how it would work.
So basically, the top four teams in each league, so the one from each group, will go forward to the playoffs, assuming they haven't qualified for Euro 2020 via their actual qualifying group.
But regardless of anything, Joe,
not like you can break water.
At the end of it, if you top your league, you go into that. You'll hit then the playoff system. The overall winner, which will be League A, B, C, and D.
Yeah.
If then, as I said before, if you win that league, you automatically then hit the playoff for the Euros. That's what you get.
When you say winning the league, what do you mean?
You win the League B.
You get one from Pot 1, one from Pot 3, and it's a three-team group, and you play them each home and away, and you got four games, and then if we win our league, we get promoted to League A.
I don't understand. So if we win our little group with the other two teams, let's say it's
not... No, not necessarily that. If you win your league.
Yeah, I was going to say, so if we win our league, say we've Northern Ireland and Wales, and we come out of that group.
Say you win all four games. That's the way that you can maybe explain it a little bit. If you win all four games, you give yourself a great chance of winning the league, because it's going to come down to goal difference and everything will probably...
So what do you have to do to win your league? I get we have a little group within a league. What do you have to do to win the league, to win League B? You don't know.
Kill me there.
No, that's fine. You don't know.
Yeah, kill me there. No, yeah, let's not go into
that. No, you screwed up.
Welcome back now for a fresh voice and all the business of last night then. Nathan Murphy was match commentator alongside Stephen Hunt last night. Hello, Nathan.
How are you?
I knew things were slowing down in the first half when you started asking Stephen if he was a dog, what dog would he be?
I think you asked that question.
You said to him, actually, if you were going to buy a dog, what dog would you get?
In my defence, I didn't bring the dogs up. He randomly, as is Stephen Hunt's way, randomly brought up that he had noticed that both Kilbane and Andrews had brought their dogs in. Went on to speak for a good 2 minutes about how he wanted to bring his dog in before eventually admitting that he didn't even have a dog.
Yeah.
It was that sort of night.
Precisely. He may not have brought that subject matter up if what was happening on the pitch was exhilarating.
And it wasn't.
The other takeaway from the evening, of course, is that Stephen Hunt really needs some basic help. As in, he turned up and said, I haven't eaten in 24 hours.
Well, I have told you the story of my first ever commentary for Off the Ball with Stephen Hunt.
No.
White Hart Lane, North London Derby. Obviously, it's my first ever commentary. I'm a little bit nervous and it's a big game. And I'm with Stephen Hunt. So I get a call about 9 o'clock in the morning. I've just landed at Stansted from Hunty saying, oh, I'm already in London. I came down early, been up all night. So I arrived down, meet him at about 1 o'clock. Because he'd taken 3 or 4 caffeine tablets the day before and didn't end up playing.
Oh.
So he had all this energy that he couldn't burn off. So he woke up about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, he was still in bed, couldn't get sleep. He's like, I'll just get up and drive to London now. It's about 2 hours. I'll get down early, I'll sleep in the car. Didn't sleep in the car. Meet him about 1 o'clock, game's at 4. Say about 3, he's asleep in the corner of the press room.
Conked out.
Bizarre. This is what you're dealing with.
So I said, I remember saying, you haven't eaten in 24 hours. He's like, no, it's just busy. Okay. What have you had? I've had 3 cups of coffee today.
He loves his caffeine.
He's living like a dysfunctional jockey.
Mm.
How many... That's interesting with the caffeine tablets keeping him up all night. How many cups of coffee is one caffeine tablet?
Oh, I would have thought for a caffeine pill, you're probably looking at 3 or 4
cups of coffee.
Strong cups of coffee and one caffeine pill.
Anyway, Stephen Hunt was there. He was disappointed. If you read his piece in the Sunday Independent, he was quite positive about things on Saturday night against Denmark. Mm. I would say he was less positive last night. He particularly took offence to the way the game unravelled in the last 20 minutes. Now, I argued with him that, well, look, do you not want O'Neill to at least go for it? Is there not something admirable about a manager who is under a lot of pressure not just taking the easy 1-0 defeat and instead risking a 3-0 defeat to actually go and try and get something out of the game? And he said, yeah, but not really. And actually, that started when there was 20 minutes left and the whole thing just turned into madness. And really, we're only one goal down, not five goals down. So you're only one goal down, should it go that scrappy? He wasn't so sure. What did you make of the whole evening on the whole?
Well, on that, I think a lot of the frustration about the substitutions, and you can't fault Martin O'Neill for going for it and putting on three strikers at the end, is actually, if you think back to Denmark last November at the Aviva Stadium, it was also panic stations with the substitutions at half-time.
Yeah.
When we're only 2-1 down to Denmark, there is a way of actually fighting your way back into this. You get a goal on the hour mark and you have this huge finale and you score a last-minute winner. Instead, he made these radical changes, totally changed the tactics that he'd pretty much gone with for the previous 2 years, and Ireland got ripped apart because nobody knew what they were doing. And that was sort of the sense last night for those final 20 minutes. We were playing a 2-4-4 formation for a good bit of the last 20 minutes, with our two centre-halves being Shane Duffy and Richard Keogh, who don't have an ounce of pace between them. So it just smacked of desperation. But then it was desperate. Martin O'Neill, I guess, knew what the stakes were. He knew the pressure that was coming down the line. I was alongside Stephen on Saturday night as well, and his feeling was that two things. The players were playing for the manager, which there were questions over that it was a totally dysfunctional setup. Yeah. And you'd have to agree with that. They certainly showed pride, whether that's pride for the manager or pride for themselves. I would imagine there's a little bit of both. There's always pride for themselves and wanting to go out and do themselves justice and not be humiliated like they've been over the last couple of times.
Yeah.
But also that he felt defensively we were a lot more solid. But how could we not have been when we were playing with a five-man defence and a couple more extremely defensive players in the middle midfield? There's never going to be any space.
And they had the benefit of Saturday night together to at least iron out the kinks.
Exactly. And that's the difference last night. I thought Wales had a pretty similar shape at times when they didn't have the ball. They flooded men back. The difference they had was that they had Brooks and Lawrence, who had the ability to bring the ball forward even 30, 40 yards, to skip past a couple of tackles, bring it out to the wing, hold on to it, wait for the other players to come forward. Whereas we never seem to have that at all.
We touched on some of the problems earlier in the show, you know, the likes of, for Christie, understandably, it's tough for him to get turned on the ball. I wouldn't say Harry Arthur or Jeff Hendrick are doing it brilliantly either. So quite often it struck me there was a real determination to keep the ball. You could see it from the first minute, the first whistle. And I mean, it was a lot of passing around the back. And every time it went into midfield, it came straight back to them. Now, there must be a way for one of those three midfielders to get themselves on a certain angle where they can at least not have to give it back to Shane Duffy for the fifth time in a row. But that really didn't seem to happen very much. Callum Robinson, one of the few, and as Stephen Hunt said last night, that's because he's coming from a bit deeper, he gets a bit more space. I mean, on the point about the throwing the kitchen sink at it, it's such an indictment of where we are that actually a one-goal deficit is so big for this Irish team because we find it so hard to score that really we treat a one-goal deficit, i.e. throwing the kitchen sink at a team, the same way another team might treat 2 or 3-0. Like, if we go a goal down now and there's 20 minutes left, we actually just have to throw everything at it.
It's an absolute crisis at this stage, our lack of gold at home. When you go back through the last World Cup campaign against Austria, Serbia, Wales at home, the constant struggle. And in fact, you think back to that Austria game, John Walter scores in the last minute. It was again from a sense of adding a little bit of chaos to the match. We could have easily conceded, but we just threw everything at them and this time it worked out in our favour.
Yeah.
The issue, and this is where I guess Martin O'Neill gets a little bit of leeway, is again, you're looking and wondering who those players are. Who are the link-up guys? Who are the David Brooks and Tom Lawrence? Remember, Brooks is playing, actually, maybe again, that's an indictment when I think about it. Like, Brooks is playing for Bournemouth, Lawrence is playing for Derby. Mm-hmm. These aren't actually world-class players.
Yeah.
They're not Gareth Bale, Aaron Ramsey, Christian Eriksen. They're just good, solid, young, Premier League quality players who are able and probably told to do it, as John Giles will probably say tomorrow night. You know, they're not been told not to do it. Are the Irish players been told? Is Cyrus Christie, is Martin O'Neill at him at training? Listen, I'm happy with your performance on Saturday night. You got the man of the match. You played it very safe. We need more from you. Mm. When you pick up that ball, I need you to be turning to the opposition goal. And I need you to trust that Callum Robinson's going to have come short and he'll be available for that ball. I don't need you to be scared out of your life that if I turn, I'm going to get dispossessed. Richard Kerr's 10 yards away from me. He's too high up the pitch. We're going to get caught on the break. And I think that's the underlying feeling watching Ireland, is that those conversations aren't happening. There's no trust. There's no general sense of, well, if I pick up the ball in this position, four other people are going to move. Like, we saw it a couple of times with Matt Doherty where they tried him that diagonal ball. But we haven't seen that with Ireland at all under O'Neill, I don't think. There's never been a pattern of play from midfielders.
No, I think that's the big issue. And you talked about the chaos. I think the reason we look more effective in chaos is that we drag the other team into chaos. Because if a game is just played in conventional patterns that professional footballers all are used to, then we seem to not be at those races. Like, we just don't seem to have those patterns. I mean, I do have a lot of sympathy in a way for O'Neill, given the players he has to work with. I still think, fundamentally, I find the not naming the team thing weird. I find the not talking to Cyrus Christie thing all week when he's going to be playing in a new position, I find that weird. I find a lot of what we hear about the training methods weird. And yet, even if he did all that, I wonder how much better we would be. I mean, yes, we would be better. But, like, the players, I mean, Aidan O'Brien last night, just looking at him, like, trying so hard and everything. But, I mean, he doesn't really play for Millwall. He scored once all season. Like, we are just so limited. And it's just, that primarily is the big worry for me, looking on last night. I just thought, well, don't know. Look, there's definitely, sorry, point to put to you, definitely these are players who are good enough to pass a ball because they've made it in the game. So just imagine how good they were in the schoolyard. They were the most skillful player we've all seen times a billion. You know, they were phenomenally good, and yet they look too often out in the pitch like they can't trap a ball and pass it. And so that suggests to me they need more. They need more help. They need more patterns. They need more options, because you can take a decent player, decent championship player, and he can look awful in a bad system. And equally, he can perform above himself in a good system. And at the moment, we're making what I have to presume are better players than I'm seeing in an Irish jersey playing very badly. And that is an indictment of the manager. But I don't know. Like, you think of the Jack Charlton era, what's the one thing that they all had? What's the one thing they all say? Well, we knew exactly what Jack wanted us to do. Everybody knew their jobs. Didn't always agree with it. No, they hated it.
But when you're getting the results, everybody's happy with it. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We've come through generation after generation of Irish players upping their game when it comes to putting on the green jersey. Like, Kevin has spoken about it in here, making sure he was match fit from Premier League games so that when he turned up for Ireland, he was at his best. Whereas right now, and we'll see it this weekend, and the game that stands out for me last year is after the Denmark game and going to Burnley with Brian Kerr to watch Burnley against Arsenal. Jeff Hendrick and Stephen Ward played. And Hendrick played in the number 10 position. He played in a more attacking role behind the striker. Never give the ball away all game. Because every time he got it, he knew where the two central midfielders were going to be, where the left wing back was going to be, where the right wing back was going to be. And likewise, Stephen Ward. He had four or five options every time because it's drilled into them day after day. And yeah, you don't get as much time at international level, which makes it all the more important that you really are focused on what should probably be a pretty simple game
plan. It doesn't have to be a sophisticated game plan.
And there is a problem with scoring goals. Like, Shane Long, who's still our main striker, hasn't scored an international goal in 2 years. Has barely scored any goals, even at club level, in 2 years. Shaunie Maguire's never scored at international level. He's only making his third appearance last night.
Looked good last night, though.
And did. And still is nowhere near full fitness. And maybe he can emerge over the next couple of years. But you do feel that playing seven defensive players, like, that's never going to change. Then if we can't go on playing Cyrus Christie in the middle of midfield. Somebody has to come in, put a structure in place whereby midfielders can go and express themselves and feel confident. And I think that's why there needs to be a change, that quite simply he's not getting the best of the players that are there. It's gone stale. There's obviously far greater issues which you've been talking about already tonight and which we're going to talk about with Irish football, that there's not a quick fix and that we're paying the price from the last 10, 15 years. But is he getting the best out of those players right now? Definitely not.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm torn. I mean, I haven't liked the way he's approached things. Equally, I didn't have a feel of crisis last night. It didn't feel like a low ebb where, oh, okay, this guy has to go. And we are at the start of a qualifying process, and it just would feel a bit premature to me. We have to see what happens in Denmark. And the key question, as we said this evening already, is 1.9 million for O'Neill, guts of another $500,000 for Keane, I'm sure, whatever it is. So, do we have $2.5 million to get a new manager? Because Ryan Giggs is getting $400,000. So, who are we getting and how much are we paying? Like, that's the key question.
It is. And, well, with both Martin O'Neill and Giovanni Trapattoni, you never would have said that they would have ended up as Ireland managers.
Yeah.
We don't know what the budget is, but listen, is it Mick McCarthy again? I'm not quite sure.
Mm.
I don't think people would be particularly excited about a Sam Allardyce type figure coming in. It would feel like more of the same.
Well, it's the total opposite, O'Neill, in terms of organisation and drills.
It is, but yeah,
it's more.
We'd be giving out about style of football.
I actually think it would be even a mistake to bring in a Martinez type, a Guardiola type. Don't get me wrong. If Guardiola wants to manage Ireland, I'm willing to see
Fine,
where it goes.
We'll.
Yeah, but I just actually think if you look at the players we have, Guardiola has shaped Manchester City by straight away going out and spending gargantuan sums on fullbacks who play the way he needs them to play, and on attacking players. So
Pep Guardiola has the best players in the world and still feels the need to absolutely drill into them every day.
Appreciate that.
What he wants from them.
Appreciate that. But I'm just saying he has attacking players who, you know, that's in their makeup. So we don't. And therefore, although it pains me to say it, if you're going to change the manager, then there is a strong argument that maybe you have to go for a Tony Pulis, Sam Allardyce type, because look what they have to work with. If you bring Martinez into Ireland, we'll be getting hammered 4-2 every game, 6-2 every game. Do you know what I mean? And it's a grim thought, but actually, if we're going to go down this route of changing the manager, if that's what we're saying, and I'm not so sure it's time just yet, then you're going to have to bring in Big Sam, Nathan.
Well, I'd be interested to hear from
you
players
as
who've... well, the brain's trust. I'd be interested to see if you spoke to players who've worked under Sam Allardyce, and particularly maybe Tony Pulis, as to how long it takes them to implement their ideas. Whether, because it feels in a way at times as if it's a Stone Age style of football, that it'd be quite easy, that anybody could pick it up. But actually, again, Tony Pulis very much focuses on certain aspects.
I think quick enough. You see them go into clubs and turn it around in a week or two. You know, they go five at the back, four in midfield, and they get a 2-1 win or a 1-0 win quick enough in their first game. So, I don't know. We'll have to see how it all plays out. Thanks so much for popping in. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Joe.
Hi, I'm Mick McCarthy, and I'm second generation Irish. I'm very proud of it.
Are you ready for a bit of verbal sparring, eh? What have you got for me this morning? What pile of have you got for me this morning?
I answer questions on anything, religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems. And if I haven't experienced them, I know somebody who has. So, you know.
Some people might think that's 2 points job, and I say some people can f*** off.
Yeah, but I don't give a flying about and slaughtering. I told you before, did not. It's like. If anybody's not happy, write to me at goandgetyourselffettled.com. Have you come in the red suit and the white beard today, or what? Shall I come and sit on your lap and ask?
Does your father know I'll bet?
Oh, I haven't told him yet.
I just wonder, do you...
Sorry, the keeper's a big tart doing that, because there's nothing wrong with it.
I said, are you the physio? He said, no, I am the head of medicine. Oh, and I said to him, how wide's your door? So can you just put physiotherapist on it like everybody else used to?
And like I say, if I've lost anything, any friends, then they're lost, believe me. I am pleased I'm that. And I'm pleased I came off tonight, and I'm pleased I was angry, and I'm pleased I shed a few tears, and I'm pleased I kicked that coffee pot across the room. And I'm pleased I feel like I do now, because I know the old feeling's still there. And when that goes, then if that feeling goes, I'll pack it in.
Now, after winning a French title back in 97, Thierry Henry has rejoined Monaco as their manager. Julien Rennes is on the line. Hello.
Hello, guys.
How you doing? So Thierry Henry is going back. This seems like a real glamour appointment for a glamour club.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's an incredible story, really, to be fair. And it's interesting you point out the glamorous aspect of it, because the story goes that before Jardim's last game, a couple of weeks ago, there were only 10 journalists turning up at his press conference. And the club was really shocked. They were like, they were not happy at all. And they said, this is not what we want. We don't want to have fallen so far away from, you know, from like news and things like that, that no one cares about what our managers are saying. And I think the idea as well, when they sacked Jardim, was to get someone in that would bring the club back into news headlines, news bulletin, you know, back pages, front pages, whatever you want to call it. And I think Thierry, as much as obviously the bright manager that they see in him, is also that big name that was always going to bring back Monaco into those kind of limelight, really. Yeah. And I think Well, we saw that in his press conference today. We saw that since he was announced that he was the new manager, because, you know, in terms of media frenzy, that's been crazy for them. And I think that's also exactly what they wanted.
Hey, look, it's the reason we're on the phone to you. And I guess it's part of their bid to steal some back pages from Neymar and PSG and Mbappe. Because Jorim, I mean, I'm wondering how bad a job he did, given that he led them to the French title and we saw what they did in the Champions League. And in fairness, the team was fairly decimated. Lots of their best players left. So, you know, is he been slightly harshly treated here? Won the French title, followed up by finishing second, and then had a bad start admittedly to the season?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing, I agree with you, and I think there's a few people who felt like that, but Jardim was happy to go. I think Jardim himself realised that it was the end for him at the club, that he couldn't bring this club forward, this team forward anymore, that he ran out of ideas. I think he ran out of energy as well. I think all those successes, which were incredible, made him a bit... complacent is the wrong word, but, you know, made him a bit big time in a way. Mm. And I don't think he had the same meticulous approach that he had before. I don't think he had the same hunger that he had before. And maybe it's normal, because when you defy all the odds, when you achieve far more than you should have, really, after 4 years, maybe you feel like that. Maybe anyone would have been in his position would have felt the same. So I can see why he felt like that, and I can see why Monaco felt it. It's not really they sacked him. I think he was far more mutual consent than what people think, that he felt I can't do this anymore, and that's why he was okay by leaving. He took a big check, you know, a big payout as well, so he would be happy right now in Madeira on a nice beach. And also the club felt, you know what, it's been great. We had a great love story. It's been wonderful. But it's just time for a new cycle and something new. And I think Jardim was okay with that. So, yeah, maybe he was a bit harsh, but I don't think he wanted more time. I think he was very happy to, you know, to put an end to it and to move on to something, and for the club to move on as well.
So Julian, I think we've touched on this maybe a bit before on the show in terms of the perception of Thierry Henry in France. I know we've had Henry the pundit in the UK and you know, he was maybe divisive in terms of that role. But
no, there was general agreement on Thierry Henry.
Yeah, maybe he wasn't divisive. But in terms of, I know like that some of the players in that France 2010 World Cup team, maybe there's been a mixed view of them. And I wonder, has Henry suffered from that, or is he a popular figure, or how would you describe it?
No, I think one of the big tasks for him going to Monaco as well is to sort of rekindle himself with the French public and with the French people. Because right now he's not popular in France. He's not the figure that he should be, considering he was, you know, one of our best players ever. But if you ask people wouldn't name him in the top three, maybe not even in the top five for some of them, because of what happened against Ireland, because of what happened in the World Cup 2010, because of a lot of things that happened with him, you know. And I think people never got him, never really understood him. And I think maybe he didn't do everything he could for people to understand him. But I think it would be very interesting to see how the French public react to him being at Monaco, him going to every Ligue 1 stadium, you know, every single weekend now until the end of the season, things like that. And maybe people will like him a bit more. But right now, there's something broken between him and the French public, for sure. And I think he always felt it. He always felt more at home in England and in London, for example, than he ever did in Paris and in France.
Very interesting. Do you know, I'm not sure how popular he is over here necessarily either, frankly, outside of Arsenal fans who love him and all of us who think he was such a great player. There was something slightly smug / disingenuous about him. Like, am I the only one who sort of gets that with Henri? Sometimes he just says things and I'm like, I don't believe you.
Yeah, I hear you 100%. I think the handball was obviously by far the lowest point of his career. I think even lower than the 2010 World Cup, where he was the one that could have stopped the strike, that could have stopped that humiliation, and he didn't do anything because he thought that by not doing anything, he would still escape, you know, all the craziness that followed that stupid, the most stupid thing that of stupidity ever. And
very stupid.
You know, and I think the handball against Ireland at the Stade de France that night, yeah, was the lowest of the low. And I think after that, everything changed. everything was different. I think before that, a lot of people already couldn't get why he was not celebrating or the way he was celebrating. People, like, you know, like we said, he looked cold. Yeah. There was a lot of things about him looking cold. But I think the handball just, yeah, in terms of his image and everything, really tarnished a lot of things. And I never thought he recovered from it. I never thought his image recovered from it as well. And after that, only of what, 6 months later, the World Cup 2010 just put the final nail in the coffin, really. So I think there was always an issue there. And I can see why you feel like that. And I think a lot of people, not just Irish or French people, but all over the world feel a bit like this too.
Yeah, I'm bringing that up aside from the handball thing. Like, I honestly am sort of over that. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't be saying that. Do you have a last Henri question?
No, just in terms of the summer just gone then, we had Henri in the Belgian camp that was on the opposite side to France in a significant sort of World Cup semi-final game. I mean, I'm guessing that was a major talking point, but is there also discussion, and was there a sense around that time of what input Henri was bringing to that Belgian setup and what we actually can expect from him now?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit weird. I was at that game. It was really weird to see him on the other bench. God knows what he thought during the anthems, because he obviously doesn't sing the Belgian one, and he couldn't have sung the French one either, considering they were the opposition. So, you know, he must have felt weird emotions and mixed feelings and all of that. In terms of him as a coach, no one knows. I'm not sure he knows himself. He probably has a philosophy of play, a style of play. And when Arsene Wenger and Pep Guardiola are two of your biggest influences, or maybe just your two influences, I guess we can have an idea of what kind of football he wants to play, and not just some of that style of kick and rush football. You know, that's what I'm hoping for Monaco, that it will be, attacking, you know, that kind of football. But I don't think we know. I think what he will bring, though, his charisma and his experience as a player, because as manager he's got none. But as a player, and I think he will have that input on details, that he knows how important it is. He will be very demanding. And that's the question as well. How will he respond if his team is not, you know, fulfilling his expectations? Because as a player, if a teammate, you know, was not at the level that Thierry expected, I think the teammates, you know, could have been in for like a long hairdryer treatment. I'm not sure he can do that right now in a squad that 18th in the league, have won one game in 12, and that game was on the 11th of August. So he will have to be patient. He will have to be maybe a bit calmer than he was as a player. He would have to be, you know, use his mind a bit more than his instinct, maybe. I'm not sure, but it'd be very interesting to see if they lose at Strasbourg at the weekend, you know, what is he going to do? It's going to be really fascinating, I think.
Yeah, for sure. That's interesting. I didn't actually realise he was a hairdryer type teammate to those not performing. One last thing, completely different before I let you go, Julian. So, Koscielny obviously missed out at the World Cup and was pretty honest in his comments afterwards about just how miserable it was being injured and watching your teammates win a World Cup. So he said, "The World Cup will remain a dark spot of my career. I have a selfish side. I tell myself that I could have been part of the adventure and won the World Cup. I was really happy for them, but also disgusted. It's a strange feeling that during the tournament I wanted them to qualify, but at the same time I wanted them to lose. It feels like a hit on the back of the head." So, I mean, wow, and I dare say it's how any injured player or any player left out of a squad feels when their own country has such success. The interesting thing I thought was that he said, Deschamps called me once for my birthday in September. He's talking about the September after the World Cup, I guess to check in on him or just to say hi. But he says, "Otherwise, no. Lots of people disappointed me, not only the coach." And quite generously, I thought, Deschamps didn't think Koscielny was being a bit demanding here. He said, "I understand the disappointment. I reached out for an update in September. That, at a bare minimum, I did. I could have done more," which was a generous enough response, I thought, from Deschamps. What do you make of all this?
It's an interesting one. I may be biased because I like Koscielny a lot, and I can see his point, and I know how frustrated he was and how almost depressed he was during that time, being injured as well. And it's a long injury. It's not just that he twisted his ankle and couldn't travel. You know,
it's
a long injury, and he had to suffer in rehab to come back and all of that. And I think on top of that, seeing your teammate, you know, your friends, your manager, where you should be and you're not winning the World Cup, it must be heartbreaking. And I think that interview on Sunday night on French television was like a closure for him. He had to say it. He had to open up he did. Now he's, you know, he doesn't care what people think. He doesn't care about the debate. He just had something to say, which he used as a closure, and now he can move on, because I think he really struggled to move on before that interview on Sunday. I think Deschamps had the right attitude. There was no need to, you know, to sort of fight back have a go back at Koscielny. I think he understands. And it's funny because Deschamps said that actually he called him more than once, and that he texted him as well, that he also discussed with him what surgeon to use for his injury, his Achilles injury, and things like that. So, listen, I'm not sure who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah.
I just know that Koscielny was hurt. He was deeply hurt. And maybe Deschamps could have done more. Maybe the rest of the squad could have done more. But it's difficult. You're in your own bubble at the World Cup. And I'm not sure they were thinking about Laurent Koscielny a lot at that time either. So I think it's a tricky one. I'm glad he opened up, because I think it will do him a lot of good and it will make him feel better. But I can see why Deschamps was a bit upset and his staff was upset. They texted each other on Sunday night, so straight after the interview was broadcasted.
Right.
And I think Deschamps and Koscielny both felt good to talk again straight after that.
Mm.
And I hope that, you know, they've all put that behind them. And who knows? He said he wants to retire, but listen, he plays well with Arsenal. Deschamps calls him back. He might go back, and we might have a happy ending with a 2020 Euro win with Koscielny in that squad. Who knows?
Who knows? Julian, pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thanks, boys. Thank you very much.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.